Hey folks, Rob Wolf here. The wait is over. Wired to Eat is now available anywhere books are sold. You can check it out also at wiredtoeat.com. Hey folks, Rob Wolf here. Another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Really, really excited for today's guest. First guest is Matt Thornton. Matt is one of my personal heroes. He is the founder of the Straight Blast Gym organization. He is a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt and really someone that has dramatically influenced my thinking in the whole Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu scene and far beyond that, as we will talk about a bit today. Our other guest is Peter Boghossian. Peter is an assistant professor of philosophy at Portland State University. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Rob. I'm very happy to be here.
Thanks, Rob.
So we're going to talk about a lot of topics today, but I'd like to focus on a paper that, Peter, you co-authored and I believe was inspired not insignificantly by Matt's work. The title is Critical Thinking, Pedagogy, and Jiu-Jitsu, Wedding Physical Resistance to Critical Thinking. That's a big mouthful, and I there's a lot of stuff I'd like to unpack just in the title of that. But before we get into that, I have a tendency of doing very paltry introductions and background bios. I'd like both of you guys to maybe dig in a bit more into your background. Matt, let's go ahead and start with you.
Sure. Lifelong martial artist, obsessed with martial arts, got involved in Jeet Kune Do concepts when I left the military back in the very late 80s, because the idea that Bruce Lee had of stand-up, clinch, and ground, or as they put it back then, four ranges, and being able to fight at all the different ranges made sense to me. I was boxing at the time, and I knew I needed to be able to fight on the ground, as an example from some fights I've been in. I moved up to Portland because of a job I had, started teaching up here, was boxing at a boxing gym up here, and by happenstance, I met Fabio Santos, who was one of Holes Gracie's and Hickson's first black belts, and he was just up here building boats and surfboards and things. He wasn't teaching, and he had put an ad in the newspaper, this is pre-internet, asking for people to come, and he would pay if he would come and try to beat him up. and my buddy and I were both boxing at the boxing gym all the time. We looked at each other and we were saying, well, we get beat up all the time for free, so we might as well get paid for it. So, long story short, I went there. Fabio's an awesome guy. It was predictable, body lock, takedown, mount. I'd roll, he'd choke. And I knew right away I wanted to learn what he had. I started doing some privates. He got snatched up not great with time, but I think it was about a year before the first UFC because Hornian realized he was going to need staff. So he left Portland. And around that same time or somewhere in there, I also ran into Hicks and Gracie. And, the rest is history. I was obsessed with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I realized I didn't want to go the JKD concepts route because I had a lot of issues with a lot of their philosophy and what I saw as a lot of hypocrisy in that community. I opened up my first school under the assumption I wouldn't be able to make any money because all the guys were always telling me people just want to click sticks together and collect certificates and you're going to be poor. So I figured I'd be poor. And turned out well for me. So I've been able to travel all over the world. I received my black belt 2001 from my coach through Purple, Brown, and Black, which is Chris Howder, who's been a huge influence on me. And as you most listeners or you probably know, we have gyms all over the world, and many of my coaches have gone on to tremendous success, like John Kavanaugh with his athletes and Conor McGregor and other people. So I'm very proud of where the organization went. I'm humbled by what my students have been able to accomplish, and I'm grateful to be here and have a conversation with you.
That's fantastic. It's nice to see something built on integrity and a desire to really legitimately help people really just barnstorm and succeed. So congratulations to you. And seriously, thank you for all the work that you've done. I don't know if you even remember your old website where you broke down the zone diet and how you use that for some of your competition prep and stuff like that. But I've been following your work for ages. I actually have downloaded, printed out, sheets of when you were tinkering with your nutrition, your map theory of jiu-jitsu and whatnot. So I've been following your work for a long time. It's just been a huge influence.
Thank you, Rob. I'm honored.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Peter, give us some background, and also, can you tell us what the heck pedagogy is?
Sure. Before I start, I will say that your work has influenced me. I have Crohn's disease, and I read your first book, and I felt so good once I followed that, particularly the grains and the wheats and such, and decreased my carbs and sugars. So that was a huge physical benefit to me. So thank you for that.
Fantastic. Thank you. I guess a little bit in the vein of this this whole paper and this discussion of critical thinking, you know, my greasy used car salesman pitch around this stuff is try it for 30 days, see how it works, and then assess the cost-benefit ratio and see if it works for you. And it's been going pretty well.
Yeah, it's been fantastic for me. Every once in a while, I have a passion for popcorn, and I go out on a date with my wife, and I have a box of popcorn, but I wish I could have the fortitude to not do that because I never feel good afterward, although it's fun at the time.
I tell you, in the grand scheme of dalliances, that's not too bad. So I'll sign off on that one, no problem.
Okay, yeah. Good. All right, well, that actually makes me, your approbation makes me feel a lot better about it. So pedagogy is just a teaching method, a way of teaching, a way of instructing people. And so one of the things I've been training with Matt for years, one of the things that Matt has taught is the importance of a resisting opponent. And Matt was one of the people who originally talked about superstition in the martial arts and made some of those superstitious practices clear for what they are. And that's, well, superstition. And so there are many ways to look at that. But in the paper, it talks about kata, and it's a form. People used to do that, as you know, for years and years, and that was the way that people trained. The problem with that, though, is that there's no resisting opponent. And so there's no relationship between doing kata and becoming a better fighter. In fact, there may even be an inverse relationship between the two, because the more you do kata and the cooler it looks, the better you think you can fight, and then the more entrenched in your own delusions you become. So there's no corrective mechanism with kata, and that's exactly what we see in the academy and the ways things are taught, the way people memorize things without engaging them. So as someone who's been practicing jiu-jitsu for a long time, what was interesting to me is if you forget about the art and you just looked at the pedagogy, the teaching method, the method of instruction, the method that Matt uses is the I method, and he can talk about that in a second. And I thought, well, why can't we use, well, okay, even if we take a step back, if you forget about the arts, people who use certain teaching methods in combat arts against resisting opponents, those people are always more successful than people who don't use certain teaching methods. So I thought to myself, well, if this holds in the physical domain, why doesn't it hold in the cognitive domain? I mean, we certainly have indications that ways that we can correct our thinking would be not only helpful to us, but it seems that we could teach other people these things. All right, so I said a lot there, so I'll pause before I go on.
No, that's it. That's fantastic. And maybe I can dovetail that into a little bit of the abstract. So I'm reading from the paper. This paper argues that training methodologies similar to those in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and other realistic combat sports like Western boxing, Muay Thai kickboxing, and college wrestling should constitute a pedagogical core of college critical thinking courses. To make this argument, first, we briefly define and explain critical thinking using the American Philosophical Association's Delphi report. Can you unpack a little bit about what was in that report and what critical thinking is? It was pretty interesting how they delineated that. And then also you, in the paper, made some interesting observations about, even though they maybe defined that process or I guess process is the right term for it, but there was really in most of critical thinking courses and in so many courses in general, there's very little kind of ritualistic training that occurs. Ironically, there's not actually a progressive overload system for getting people to move through that process. It's very happenstance.
Yeah, and ironic is the perfect word, because you're supposed to be teaching people how to think critically, but you don't know if the content you're teaching them and the method of teaching actually achieves what you think it achieves. So there's a layers of irony within that.
Absolutely. So could you talk a little bit about the Delphi report and like how they actually determine critical thinking?
Sure. So it's actually a fascinating thing. They took them 2 years. They had experts from every field. And what they would do is they would send out kind of a questionnaire with a bunch of items. Do you think critical thinking is this, this, this? And then they had spaces, you know, fill in what you think critical thinking is. And then they do that over multiple iterations until they received a consensus. So the consensus from the experts and then it lists the consensus. But here's the interesting thing about that. And this is absolutely fascinating and applicable in every domain of our lives, socially, politically, morally, etc. They determine that critical thinking is two things. It's a skill set and it's an attitude. And in college classrooms, we teach the skill set. In other words, we teach kata, but we don't teach the attitude. So we teach, for example, how to identify a fallacy and how to attach a label to the fallacy. You know, this is ad hominem, this is attacking the person, you know, A, B, C, D. But they don't teach a skill set. For here's an example of a skill, being willing to revise your beliefs. Right? That's probably, in my opinion, being trustful of reason is another one. So let's take that and put it in a martial arts context. So if I came in here or someone came in here today and told Matt, and Matt's right next to me, he can tell you what he thinks. If they said, Matt, I have and I think I wrote about this in the paper, I have a technique called the pinky technique.
Right.
And I will use my pinky to defeat your best opponents. Can we test that out? What would you say to that? Absolutely.
let me get my GoPro and here's a waiver.
that's right. So absolutely you would test that out, right? So it's pretty easy to adjudicate these things in the physical realm, right? You just have someone who makes a claim, you match them against someone who's pretty same, more or less the same weight, height, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So what we see teaching, so in college classrooms, it's very easy to teach the skill set and it's very easy to assess that. That's the key thing, right? You just look at the multiple choice, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't teach the attitude. In fact, most people don't even talk about the attitude. How do you help people to become more trustful of reason? How do you help them to revise their beliefs? How do you help them to have certain values? And the big insight that I've had from teaching this for, I don't know, more than two decades is that the value has to precede the skill set. That the value that we teach people to have to, for example, revise their beliefs on the base of evidence, that they should value evidence. If people don't value that, then they're not going to use the skill set for things that matter. So it's like they're doing kata, right? Everybody in these classes, they're all doing kata and then they're congratulating themselves because their kata looks so good. But the kata doesn't apply to things in real life. One of my colleagues, when he read the paper, said, oh, that's like doing layups without a person. And I mentioned that to Matt. And he said, it's like playing basketball without a basketball.
Without a ball, yeah.
And that's why, and Matt has talked about this, that's why when you see all these demonstrations, don't look at the person throwing people around like magic. Look at the people coming at him. Look at the dummies. You know, look at the UKs or whatever the terms in Japanese. Look at those people. Look at the feeders, not the actor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Matt, you really coined and have popularized this term aliveness, and then Straight Blast Gym. I know methodologies like this have kind of been out there, but you guys really formalized and codified this I method. Could you talk a little bit about that and kind of we'll contextualize it within Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and combatives, and then maybe, Peter, we can kind of pull this out and look at it from the perspective of a critical thinking class.
Sure. When I started, you know, for whatever reason, and I don't know the answer to this, and I'm not sure it matters, but from a very early age, I was kind of obsessed with what's real and what's not real in martial arts. And by what's real, I mean what's actually going to work. And that's what drew me to Jeet Kune Do Concepts originally. And what I saw in that community as I was training with those guys and teaching me some of the arts was some of it was functional and some of it was not. Many of the arts were functional. Many of them were fantasy. And you'd have a book like Absorb What Is Useful for the old martial arts people out there might remember that book with Dan and Asano and Paul Bunak, where they would demonstrate the differences between the Jung Fong kickboxing in comparison to something like Shotokan. And they'd have side-by-side comparisons with one being, of course, inferior by definition, according to what they were writing down. But then at the same time, they were enamored with an art like Silat, which in many ways made Shotokan look functional. And so I'm watching this hypocrisy, and I notice that they don't understand how to think about martial arts. And the question that would come up time and time again to me by sincere people is, you know, what arts work and what arts don't. Why does an art like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu work so well and an art, for example, like Japanese Jiu-Jitsu, as it's typically taught, although it might contain the same moves and have the same techniques, they could give you a Japanese name for most of the movements we do in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Your typical white belt with three stripes from a BJJ class will run circles around, you know, a Japanese Jiu-Jitsu black belt. Why is that? And rather than have to explain it step by step, the one word answer I came up for that with that is aliveness. And aliveness is timing, energy, and motion. And those are kind of three words for the same thing, which is aliveness. But if you're missing one of those elements, then what you're doing is not alive. And that gets misconstrued by people who say, well, that's sparring. And then we have to explain a little bit deeper. And because the immediate objection they'll throw out is, well, you can't just throw people into sparring, which, of course, we never have. But when I'm really talking about aliveness, I'm talking about how we train. A really simple example to take it out of martial arts for a second would be, I taught my daughter to teach badminton about a year ago. So my wife brought home a badminton set. So it's two, you know, the two rackets and the bird. And I lobbed it at her. I sure how to hold the racket, sure how to swing it a couple times, introduction stage. I lobbed the bird at her and she misses it. I do it a few more times, maybe a little slower, maybe a little closer, whatever I need to do. And eventually she managed to hit it with the racket and went way over on the other side of the grass. I had to pick it up and she hits it again. And pretty soon she's hitting it towards me. And after about an hour, she was able to hit it to me and I was able to hit it back. That's aliveness. So I introduced the basic technique and then she's hitting something that's moving with timing, energy, and motion, which was, you know, the bird, the ball and badminton. If I was going to use a traditional martial arts training method, I would have her practice swinging the racket in the air, create a kata for her, correct her as she was doing it, you know, it'd be a long time before she ever maybe even saw a bird. And that's, to me, that is the secret of why some things work and some things don't in martial arts. And Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, even if it's taught poorly, even if the instructor's a bad instructor, even if they don't know understand much about drilling in the typical tech classes, here's some techniques I just, random techniques I just like, and now everybody, let's roll and try and kill each other, which is not that uncommon. But in that, even in that environment, people will learn how to do jiu-jitsu because they're working against a resisting opponent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is where it dovetails with philosophy. I heard Daniel Dennett talk about this years ago where he talked about the opponent process. And anytime results matter, we go to a meritocratic format and we're going to have competition, whether it's business or military results or sports results. And that's why combat sports have always been functional, because they care about the results, whether it's wrestling or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. That's why those are the arts you see in the UFC. And that's the same thing with science. You know, science in a way is a rigorous form of competition. It has an opponent process. And, you know, when it's working correctly, whatever hypothesis or experiments or papers that you have to be presented in front of equal peers, you know, your peers, worthy competition, who are then going to try and tear it down. And it's only the ideas and experiments that survive that process ultimately that should make it to become published. And still those conclusions are always open to revision,
right.
As are ours. So, you know, it's what you're finding there is a measurement that's likely to admit to ever-increasing complexity. When I do a rear naked choke, there's a proper way to do it. There's worse ways and better ways to do it, but I'm still open to finding more efficient ways to do it. And the better you get at it, by definition, the more efficient you get. And that's an ever increasing, you know, complexity to it. But it's still an empirical process. So that's where it all ties together, I think, with aliveness and philosophy.
I love that explanation, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I would see that as an iterative process also, which I think really throws a lot of people off. Like, there's this assumption, and I had a question later, which maybe we'll address this now to some degree, but is there something in the human psyche, like some of our, you know, evolutionary past, that we really put things into a black and white context, and that's kind of our reactive default mode? And then understanding that life and science and combatives can and should be an iterative process, that we're going to learn new things over time and there will be refinements. Like, that seems to be a very prickly, uncomfortable experience for a lot of people.
Well, I'll let Pete answer that, but one thing I'll say that I learned from Pete's work, because over the years I've gone into his classes, I've watched him teach his critical thinking classes, and people have, it's surprising to me, because sometimes I'm always afraid I'm trafficking in common sense, because everything I feel like I'm teaching seems to me like common sense. It always has. But then I'll watch him teach his class, and people become very confused over simple things like the difference between a subjective and an objective question. Whether or not they can get in long arguments about whether or not we should have chairs in a room. And I'll grant you, people can come from different cultures and have different reasons why there should or should not be chairs in a room. But if you say there's chairs in a room and I say there's not chairs in a room, one of us is wrong. Right. And when it comes to physical martial arts, it's an empirical science in the sense that there are better ways to do things. It's not all arts have something good. No, some things will make you worse as a fighter and some things will make you better. The questions about fighting are questions about whether or not there are chairs in a room, not whether or not there should be chairs in a room. And until people can understand that and understand how to think critically, sometimes I think they can become very confused.
Yeah, I want to piggyback off of a couple of things Matt said. I'm sure you and your listeners have seen those movies in which, you know what a horse stance is?
Yep.
Okay, so there are, hundreds and hundreds of people in horse stances, and they're they're punching. Are you familiar with?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the opening of, I think, like Enter the Dragon has something like that. Yeah, there you go.
Right on. Okay, so there's no aliveness in there. There's no timing, energy, and motion. What people think it's going to do for them, it is simply not going to do for them. And that exact thing you see there in the physical domain is what's happening in classrooms in general, and specifically in critical thinking classrooms in general. It's all this self-congratulatory kata silliness in which people think that they're learning these skills, and they're really not learning the skills. I mean, people are learning the skill of being, quote unquote, better at what it means to be in a horse stance and delivering a hip punch. But in terms of its applicability, there's no applicability.
Right.
So I think what we have and then the thing that's worse is that it's even self-congratulatory at the stage above that. And that is, it's either, oh, yes, look at this. Look at how well our students do kata. Look at how well people can get in a horse stance and punch. But have you ever seen anybody in a UFC get in a horse stance and start punching? And if you have, what is the result been?
I remember some wacky stuff back in the 1993 time that got weeded out quite quickly. Yeah,
exactly. So what I'm arguing for is that we need to be more mindful of, first of all, we need to be more humble about what it is that we think we're teaching if you're an educator and you're attempting to teach critical thinking, because it's not clear to me that, in fact, it's pretty clear to me that there is no evidence that, knowing the name of the fallacy in Latin is going to help students in any way whatsoever. But beyond that, we need to incorporate these elements of aliveness with the I method, exactly the way Matt just talked about introducing his daughter. If we could move, and then here's a huge thought, but if we could move to this practical level, then I think we could shift people's attitudes. And that's a weird thought, and I'm going to ask Matt to jump in a second, but let's say that you practice an art that you're engaging in behaviors that think make you a better fighter, and they don't make you a better fighter, and then you rise up in the ranks. Now, jump in here, Matt. Over time, that would make the people at the top kind of dicks, right?
Well, I'll give you a perfect analogy.
Okay.
I mean, Rob, you've been around the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu community for a long time too. And in any community, you're going to have, you know, people who can be assholes. And there's certainly people who are dicks in the Jiu-Jitsu community. But by and large, having traveled around the world, I've been to a lot of competitions and that kind of thing. Most of the people that do our sport and do what we do tend to be pretty nice people. And the competitors, especially the ones that compete the most, tend to oftentimes be some of the most humble people in the art. I think of people like Marcelo Garcia and people like that, because obviously they gain a sense of true confidence, confidence based in their actual ability to perform a skill set. You can't fake being good at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu any more than I could fake speaking Spanish or being able to play the guitar. But in an art like Aikido or in an art like Wing Chun or some of these other arts that are fantasy based, where you're always dealing not with a fully alive opponent, but with a cooperating opponent in a form of choreography or two-person patterns, you can pretend to be very good. And then over time, you can create a kind of a personality or a persona that you are forced to live up to, which you know somewhere, I think most of these guys know deep down, it's not authentic, and that doesn't tend to have good effects on people's personalities. So some of the biggest douchebags I've met have been in Aikido schools, places like that, and you walk in and there's just so much arrogance. And it's obvious to me why there's so much, and again, I'm painting with a broad brush, but oftentimes there's so much arrogance because what they're doing is make-believe. Right. And at a certain point, after a certain number of years, you're going to figure that out. Right. The ones that don't know it are the ones that are willing to test it.
Right. So let me piggyback on that. That's why, Rob, you need what you see in these quote-unquote fake arts is extra rigmarole, bowing and master and all this silliness. You need this because that makes up for the differential between one's actual ability and one's perceived ability. So you need to set these hierarchical, ritualistic practices to embed deference to the master, because the master is the whole thing is built on a house of cards.
Same thing with
religion, by the way, very similar process that happens in religion.
Well, and it's kind of funny. Like when I look at, say, engineering, particularly like electrical or mechanical engineering, and I look over at medicine, medicine, as the research generally occurs, as the process kind of moves forward, it looks more like some sort of witchcraft or voodoo or something versus what the engineers have going on. And the pecking order and hierarchy and structure and reticence to really call foul on stuff that's not working is really pretty amazing. But yet these are clearly some very bright, educated people. But I don't know if this is just a story of, as things get more complex, it's a bit more difficult to pin things down. But it's been interesting to me when I look out at, say, like nutritional science, which is kind of the area that I'm in. When you get an engineer that starts looking at this stuff, say like multiple people, a person has a spouse who develops type 1 diabetes. They don't like the way it's being managed. Seems like it's just kind of a mess. They get in and really learn the physiology and the biochemistry, and they're like, oh, we're going to do a lower carb diet and we're going to have much better results with this. But it's this kind of iterative process and the training that engineers go through, and I just don't see many engineers that end up adopting, say, like a mega high carb, low protein type of eating program. Like, it's interesting, like there seems to be this attractor that pulls it all towards this kind of one area. Do you guys think that that's part of the difference in the training of an engineer versus someone who goes into medicine? Is it a complexity story? Like, why is there such a gap there? And then maybe additionally, Matt, do you see almost like from a employment or a work history kind of background, like, are engineers disproportionately inclined to be jiu-jitsu practitioners, whereas maybe somebody in a different field may be more inclined to some of this fantasy martial art type stuff?
That's interesting. Yeah, definitely with engineers. John Kavanaugh has a degree in engineering, and a lot of the black belts I can think of have degrees in engineering or backgrounds in engineering. And there's something about thinking like an engineer, I think, that blends itself well with jiu-jitsu, because they're able to think about structure and, you know, weight and carrying weight and leverage and things like that in a way that I think is really productive. I can't really speak to the difference in nutritional science, except to say, I think to state the obvious is that a lot of that I think has to do with the incentives over the years and who's funding a lot of that research, you know, as opposed to engineering, where Boeing wants to absolutely make sure those planes are flying well. They have good incentive to make sure they get the next military contract.
No, I like that. I really like that. I probably 10 times a day, there's some either external or internal thought about, well, if the incentives were better aligned, we wouldn't have this problem.
So, yeah.
I wonder if the corollary to that question is that those people who've studied academic disciplines that are basically silly or things that have been influenced by postmodernism, if they're less likely to do Brazilian jiu-jitsu because their intellectual lives are based on fantasy to begin with.
Well, and that was kind of another question that I had floating around in here is there definitely seems to be kind of a looking down the nose, kind of a perception of lowbrow attributes to things like judo and boxing and wrestling and whatnot. And before we started recording, I had mentioned that there's some interesting neuroscience studies that suggest that risk assessment, risk analysis that we all hopefully develop over time actually starts from physical movement. You know, like, is jumping from this whetstone to that whetstone a good idea based off of my last experience of doing that, you know? And we've tried to develop this absolutely perfectly safe environment, and then what we're finding is that kids are terrible as they become adolescents and adults at applying any type of, again, kind of critical thinking, but, you know, on that risk analysis side. And so there definitely seems to be a reticence to value that physical struggle and also just competition at a really fundamental level.
Do you want to take that?
Yeah, that ties into what piece that you asked about earlier, which was, you know, combat training. And one of I've heard all the arguments over the last 25 years against aliveness and answer them, I think, over and over again. But one of the most common ones is, well, you guys do sports and, you know, we're training for the street or we're training for self-defense. And it's similar to what you're talking about, where people are looking down their nose at some of the combat sports as more lowbrow or low tech or however they view it. But that's of course backwards. And I think the thing I try to point out to them is, listen, if this is how somebody who's going into a grappling competition or going into a cage needs to train in order to survive and learn their skill set, how much more important is it for somebody who's trying to hang on to their handgun when the stakes are even that much higher? I mean, you want to give them an inferior training method?
And that's why it's backwards.
And that's why it's backwards. Because in the end, you know, when I talk about aliveness, I'm talking about epistemology. It's a training method. What the distinguishes Aikido from Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is the training method. And that training method works. And the training method transcends technique and it transcends environment. So I use that training method to teach someone how to escape a headlock. I'm going to use that exact same functional training method to teach someone how to hang on to their handgun. And at the core of it, when people fail to realize that, I mean, part of it is just that, you know, that there's so much misinformation out there. I think a lot of people are just sincerely misinformed and don't know. But once they've seen those arguments and it's been presented to them, and they're still not, there's a reticence to get involved, I think it's mostly a question of sincerity, you know. And if you look at the arts nowadays, I wrote an article, essay not too long ago about Sistema. And the video that I posted, which was quickly taken down after the essay went out, but then I just found another one, but it was truly ridiculous. It was one of the most ridiculous looking things. I mean, again, it's one of those things that made a lot of the hard styles of karate look really functional by comparison. You think to yourself, why would anybody fall for this? And yet it's the biggest of all the, I think, goofy martial arts out there. It's probably the most popular one right now. And then I realized, you know, the whole magic bullet idea, which is what these people who, even despite knowing better, still find themselves attracted to something as ridiculous as Sistema. Part of the key to that is that it doesn't look like the rest of martial arts. If it looked like something that you could do in MMA, they would think to themselves, oh, that's just MMA stuff. They want something that looks different. They want something that looks like it comes out of the Matrix or comes out of a movie. Yeah. Because that's really what's motivating them. So when they see these arts that actually look that ridiculous, that's part of their selling point to that clientele, is the fact that it doesn't look like something you'd actually be able to pull off in a cage. And so it goes to, you know, back to your field there. If I see someone who's grossly overweight and they're talking to me about self-defense and they're talking to me about combatives, it's very hard for me to take them seriously just because I know what the actuary table looks like. It's like, well, you, especially here in the United States, you're a lot more likely to die of heart attack or of cancer. I mean, half of us will die from heart attacks and cancer than you are to be stabbed to death in a back alley somewhere. So what are they really motivated by? You know, they're motivated by the image of being someone who's good at violence, which is, you know, another issue related to masculinity that they haven't come to grips with. And guess what? They can learn about how to deal with that in a combat sport. So not only would they learn how to fight, but they'd actually be able to deal with the underlying problem.
In a safe, progressive,
maturity problem that they have.
Right. And
exactly.
I mean, you kind of alluded to this at the beginning, that you were surprised that your methodology and your gym and your organization has been successful, because, you know, and you've talked about this so much, but, you know, people would say that folks didn't want this alive type of training, but there is a way to do it that's not brutal. It's hard. It's always hard, but it's doable. Like, there's a way to make it scaled and progressive, so that literally anybody at any point in life can get in and start making forward progress.
Yeah. Before we talk about that, let me just go back to something you said about the study and physicality.
Mm-hmm.
So I took my daughter to the playground the other day, and the playground we went to is one of these newly constructed playgrounds. I don't know if you've seen these things.
Yes.
You have kids?
Yep.
Okay. And it was just this safe space, if you will. It was totally safe. And you would really have to be creative and work to hurt yourself. So, okay, first of all, I think that is an example of a manifestation of a value that I happen to think is a good one in general. And that is, we're moving towards safety. We're moving towards, when I was a kid, we never, never did we drive with seatbelts. So just, we didn't have, I never had helmets when I rode my bike or none of that stuff. And I do think that that's important, and that shows a value of life. I also think it has a consequence. And the consequence, and then I'll relate that to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in a second. The consequence is, let's take the most extreme example. Do you ever watch Star Trek?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll admit it openly. Yeah.
My wife assures me that my encyclopedic knowledge of Star Trek is, or science fiction in general, not something to be proud of. But okay. So imagine if you lived your whole life in a holodeck. Protocols are on. You would not have any idea what an actual risk. You couldn't assess any risks because you'd never get hurt. Right? Hello?
You're falling out just a little bit.
Yeah, you guys are falling out too. So if you lived in a holodeck your whole life, you'd have no way to make a risk assessment, right?
Right.
Right? Okay. So if you play on playgrounds all the time, you'd have no way make an actual risk assessment, these super new playgrounds, right?
Right.
Okay, so let's pull from that. We can pull many lessons from that. One of the things I think that, piggybacking off of what Matt said, and his manuscript is about this now, is about having a healthy relationship to violence. A part of that is the understanding of what you cannot do. And I think we've seen all these movies with Jeff Speakman and these guys who take on, or Steven Seagal, people with bats and knives. And it's just ridiculous. It is just a fantasy, but I would go beyond a fantasy. I would say it's an extremely dangerous thing to teach people that they can somehow be the hero in their own reality that they've constructed for themselves when it comes to violence.
Right.
Yes? Okay. So I think what we see in this is the value to protect people and physically makes them more likely to hurt themselves because they can't make reasonable assessments of risk conditions, right? And I think the same thing is operating in the cognitive domain. Safe spaces, the value to protect people from ideas, it makes them more brittle and less likely to assess situations and use reason to solve those problems. That's why I think, in my opinion at least, a lot of these issues can be addressed through Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, through the I method, through aliveness, and through that type of training, because it teaches you corrective mechanisms. It teaches you how to use feedback. It teaches you what works and what doesn't. It teaches you what your limitations are. And there are very few things that I can think of that have such a comprehensive, maybe it's a fairy tale of my imagination, but it's not, you know, downhill skiing. It's not race. Although those elements are certainly present in that.
Right.
So I think the long and the short of it is that just in the physical domain, we can and think about things that are helpful. We can do so in a cognitive domain. And if you're an educator, you can teach individuals and groups of students how to value things like making accurate assessment of risks.
Yeah, to your point, you were talking about earlier, you know, aliveness is for everybody. One of the other objections that I've run into, and it's pretty common, is, well, you know, aliveness is just for young people, or aliveness is for athletes, and you know, you can't do that when you're older. And that dovetails sometimes with another one that you'll hear, which is, well, those combat sports are for when you're young, but when you get older, you know, you need Tai Chi or Aikido or something like that. And that's not just wrong, it's backwards. So first of all, aliveness is for everybody. One of my black belts, you probably know, Lily Pagel, she's 63 now, I believe. She started training with me when she was 50. And she's, you know, she's a legitimate dangerous black belt. You make a mistake, she's going to choke you or take your arm, and she's on the mat all the time training, 63. We have students in my gym now that are in their mid to late 60s, and we have kids as young as 4. My daughters are in class. And if there is a better method to do something as a young man, then I'm going to need that even more when I'm older. Right. It's not like, and if there was a better method to fight when you're older, I would use it as a young man. So what are the other athletes? So there's such misapplication of logic there. People don't think through it. But the thing, you know, I think about this, especially in the context of my daughters, when it comes to practical self-defense, in addition to getting healthy and getting in better shape, and that's going to that's going to help them in self-preservation in ways that are far more practical, especially in the United States for most people, than hand-to-hand combat. But in addition to that, just being comfortable with someone putting their hands on you, and someone trying to hold you down, and the pushing and the pulling and the physicality of jiu-jitsu is so much more important than, you know, whether or not you know to poke someone in the eye or knee them in the groin. And kids, after a very short time, anyone after a very short time of jiu-jitsu, they start to become comfortable with that, having someone grab them and try and throw them to the ground or, you know, hold them down. And for a lot of people, that is the single most important thing, because that is the thing that, if they ever should need it, is going to help them push them through past the point where they might otherwise freeze, because they're used to now physical contact. And there's a whole bunch of people, unless there's somebody that played a lot of contact sports as a youth, there's a whole bunch of people walking around who are not used to that kind of physical contact. And when you put your hands on them, you can feel it. Right. And you can feel that, you know, that fear. And that's totally normal. It's not something to be ashamed of. And they can become acclimated to that in a jiu-jitsu class in a way that is so healthy, especially, I think, not for everyone, but especially in particular my daughters. I want them to be used to that physicality too.
And they have a realistic assessment.
And they know what they can and can't do. Right. There's no illusions about what they can do and what they can't do. And that one of my black belts, my main coach here at my gym, Amanda Lawrence, she's a black belt, or Amanda Diggins now. She's a, you know, gold medal black belt competitor. And she's very, very good. But she's also absolutely aware, probably more than almost anyone in the world, about what it feels like to roll with a strong man who also knows what she knows.
Right.
And you know, what her body is capable of and what her body is not capable of. And she's far less likely to put herself in a situation that would be dangerous, let alone the way she carries herself because of her training, in a way that makes her unlikely to be selected by a predator. Even if she was, I mean, she's, in addition to all her fighting skills, she carries with her all that almost primal knowledge, as Chris Howard would say, and that's invaluable.
It being a father of two girls, I am excited that both girls are super interested in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I've been holding some pads for them and showing them a little bit of Thai boxing, and they love it. And it's been all play based so far, but I'm excited to see them progress through this whole thing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Well, guys, I want to be respectful of your time, so I want to have folks know where they can find you on the internet. But Matt, I've got one final question for you. I'm asked all the time, what should one look for in a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu gym? I have some thoughts on that, but I would much prefer hearing your thoughts on that.
That's a good question. When I would make sure that I feel comfortable and trust your gut about whether or not you feel comfortable. And then I would watch a class or participate in one. And I would want to see a mat that was had a lot of different people on it. So no matter what night you show up or day you show up here in my gym in Portland, you're going to find women on the mat. You're going to find men on the mat. You're going to find younger people, older people. So it doesn't look like a room full of 23-year-old athletes. And there's nothing wrong with having a gym for 23-year-old athletes, but if you're not a 23-year-old athlete who's looking to measure yourself against other 23-year-old athletes and you want to join a jiu-jitsu school that's going to teach you the skill in an environment where you won't get hurt, in an environment where you enjoy it, because, you know, the bottom line is if you don't enjoy it, you're not going to keep doing it. And
right.
And the name of the game here is not quit, because it takes a decade to get good at jiu-jitsu at the very least. You know, look around. Do you see a lot of different types of people, older, younger, male, female, all training together, all having a good time, all friendly? And I think, you know, if someone's honest with themselves and they walk into a class and they look around and they see that, it's probably a really good school.
I love it. And Matt,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I know, Matt, you have a book coming out in not too long. And then also, where can folks track you down on the internet?
Yes. I've been working on that for a long time, but I hope to have it done by the end of the year. They can track me down either for the martial arts. They can track down our organization at straightblastgym.com, and for my essays and writing at mattthornton.org.
Okay. And I'll get all that in the show notes. Peter, where can folks track you down?
Just Twitter is my current. I've been pretty busy with my current book, at Peter Boghossian, at PeterBoghossian.
Okay. Okay. I'll get all that stuff in the show notes. Guys, thank you again for coming on the show. Thank you also for accommodating my wacky schedule. I'm pretty convinced my wife is trying to work me to death by buying a small farm. And I think her plan is for me to die, and then she'll get a younger, better-looking husband at the end of that whole thing. So I apologize for my wacky schedule.
Well, our absolute pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
To talk to you. Thanks. And thanks for your work.
Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.